You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
See, well, it's very productive. You know, Marvel Comics. The X-Men.
Welcome to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. It is a brand new week. It is the week of Gaudete Sunday. So I guess it's all right to think pink all week. I had a terrific time yesterday tormenting my priest.
Aww.
He's a very nice man, you know. So it just made it so much easier to torment him.
We all men wear pink on Gallaudet Sunday, just so you know.
That's right. Yeah. So I went up to him and said, you know, nobody's saying, he has to wear pink, but we're all thinking it.
And, salmon. It's obviously salmon.
Of course. And at least 2 minutes of every homily across the United States was mandated by canon law be devoted to the priest and or deacon saying, this is not pink. It's rose. It's rose.
Get it but straight, folks.
When this is done, we just go, yeah, it's pink. And in fact, the deacon at the parish had like this. There was just no other word for it. It was a super pink sash.
Oh.
Compared it to the priest's vestments, which you could legitimately get away with saying were rose colored.
Right.
Especially next to the deacon's sash. The deacon's sash was just uber pink. So I got to say all those things that you long to say when you're a jerk like me, like, Father, you're looking in the pink stuff like that.
And he blushed, I'm sure.
Yes. So, yes, he blushed a shade of, what's the word I'm looking for?
Oh, yes, I think it's, yeah. Did he tell you say three Our Fathers and three Hail Marys after all that?
Another priest told me to do that, but that was because I went to confession on Saturday night. But so anyway, we're here today on this fine Monday of Gaudete Sunday week with Sherry Antonetti, all around swell gal.
Thank you.
Writer, mom of 10. So a busy person, you know. And a fruitful person.
Thank you.
So, how are you doing?
I am doing well. I'm doing very well. Ready? Good. Not ready for Christmas, but you know, we'll get there.
That's all right. You'll get there. We got more ready for Christmas yesterday because we set up our Christmas tree.
Nice.
So
nice.
That was big fun. And this year it was non-breakable ornaments because it was a little two-year-old girl named Seraphim, our granddaughter, and also a seven-year-old girl who's much more mature, of course, and then Seraphim's little sister, who's not quite one. And so they were helping us, helping those in scare quotes.
Yes. helping the way that all two-year-olds and one-year-olds and seven-year-olds do when it comes to breaking the tree.
The seven-year-old really got into it, and she was having a good time, and she could reach up high. And, you know, so we're getting out all the ornaments that don't shatter and leave pieces of tiny glass everywhere.
Yes, and do not cause bodily harm and create bad memories. Yes.
Yeah. So they would help us decorate, and then they would run off and get interested in something else for a while and go do that. And then I'd find an ornament that might be interesting to Lucy. She's very into animals right now.
That's fun.
So she, there's, what is it, like the wild krats or something like that?
Krats, wild creatures.
Anyway, so she's really into that show. And so her big goal right now is to grow up and become a zoologist or something.
That's cool.
And, so that's pretty cool. I'm impressed that a seven-year-old knows the word zoologist. And
you got to watch Kratz Creatures more. That's all I can tell you.
Yeah. So just completely out of touch. So we when I found something that was animal related, I would always give it to her. So, you know, the little, for some reason we have a lion Christmas tree ornament. I don't really know why. You accumulate a lot of Christmas tree ornaments over the years, and we've like given a bunch to our kids, and we keep trying to like fob off more on them because we never use all the Christmas ornaments.
That's
on
true.
Our tree, because we just, no tree is big enough. Maybe if it was like the one on the White House lawn or something, you know, then we could use all of our Christmas ornaments. But so we just always use a selection, and then we're forever trying to give Christmas ornaments to our kids, and they're like, we don't have room for more ornaments.
There's no room on the tree.
Well, we used to make ornaments, you know, and for a while there was this kind of the 12 days of Christmas thing going on, except for each year. So each year we'd been married, she would go out and, you know, for a while it worked, right? So
first 12 years,
five ornaments for, you know, 5 years. And so it would be this and that. But, you know, by the time you've been married for 33 years, 33 new Christmas ornaments.
That would be a bit much, yes.
So that sort of faded out at some point. But we still will get, you know, so we'll go camping on Lopez Island up in the San Juan Islands. And we go to the farmer's market, and there's like a Lopez Island Christmas ornament. So we get a Lopez Island.
Right. No, I get it. We have a lot of those homemade ones where there's people's faces from the different years, and they're paper, and they're terribly delicate, and so it's hard to keep track of them, and you're like looking at it because one of them got like wet, and so it's got a little streak on it, and you're like, okay, I think that's Regina. It might be Rita. You have to like look at the back and kind of guess the date, and you hope you're right. And you know you'll get killed if you're wrong. You know. So.
The oldest homemade or handmade Christmas ornament that we have is an incredibly fragile paper angel that I made in 1967.
Oh wow.
And it's still around, and it's got like the pipe cleaner halo and the little eyes made out of sequins. And I must say, it's still super adorable. But it's just like, it's just one of these things where I can't believe it still exists because it's so fragile. But, but there it is at the top of the tree in the place of honor. So, you know, so that's good. Cool. But yeah, we used to make like, you know, the salt dough ones where you'd bake them and then you'd paint them and stuff. And some of those lasted for a while. And then somehow there is like some kind of mold that can actually live on that incredibly salty dough. And so we had to get rid of some of them because they got all moldy and weird looking. But
That would have done me, yes.
but Christmas, I love decorating a Christmas tree. It's just one of my favorite things to do. And then when it's all done, you turn out all the lights except for the lights on the Christmas tree.
Yes.
And we got brand new strings of lights this year because our lights were looking kind of sad.
I understand.
You just sit there. And if you are smart like we are, then you make yourself a cup of hot chocolate while you're just sitting there looking at the Christmas tree and savoring the goodness. And we always get a real Christmas tree. None of this tinsel plastic garbage, because I love the smell of a Christmas tree.
Well, I have to say, we have an artificial tree, and we have for the last, 9 years had an artificial tree. Before then, we used to go out and get a really big, you know, nice fresh tree. But we lost a lot of ornaments by the tree deciding to go timber at some point during the Christmas season. And I really decided that I was done with that. Okay. And with 10 kids, you do have to worry about allergies, which I don't have to worry about with an artificial tree. And it also means I don't have to water it. And so that just made my life much less painful.
I believe that which does not kill your child makes them stronger.
But and that which exhausts mother is bad.
Well, that which does not kill you makes you stronger too, you know. So I'm just here to help. The point is, I like the smell of a Christmas tree, damn it.
You can like it, and I do too. I just don't want to clean up after. I'll put a little pine freshener, air freshener behind the tree.
So no, can have it's a little just pine.
Oh, I'll use pine salt.
That, you're the kind of person that says the carob and chocolate are interchangeable.
That's blasphemy. I'm sorry. That's sacrilege. That's going too far.
That's just wrong. Yeah. There's a cartoonist named Sandra Boynton.
Yes.
So she wrote a book years ago called Chocolate, the Consuming Passion.
I own it.
Okay. That's good. And she has the discussion of carob, and at one point she says, and she portrays the carob personality, which is a turkey.
Yes.
And it says there are some people who say that because carob can be made to approximate the color and texture of chocolate, it contains some of the same vitamins and minerals. It's basically the same as chocolate. She says, of course, the same argument can persuasively be made for dirt.
And I completely agree. Yes, she's correct. She is correct. Carob is evil. Yes, we all
That's
agree.
That's good. Well, when we come back, I thought we might spend a little time talking about influences in our lives. And so let's do that when we come back from the break. You're listening
Absolutely.
To Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Sherry Antonetti, and we'll be back on Redbox Media right after this.
Sounds good.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we're here today with Sherry Antonetti. We're spending a little bit of time today. I thought it'd be fun to talk about who are your influences? We've all got them. We've all got people who have influenced us, sometimes for good. That's really what I've got in mind today, or who are the influences who have influenced you for good. But, of course, we've also got influences who have influenced us for evil. So in fact, I would argue, that the people who have done us, the most harm in our lives as a general rule were not our enemies. Well, when you think about it, I mean, it's not your enemies who get you to, try drugs for the first time. Or, convince you that this would be a good time to shoplift.
Okay.
It's never your enemies that do that, right? It's always your friends who tempt you to do something evil. And but today we're mostly not looking at that.
We're looking at the light side. We're working towards Advent, so we want to look at light and good
looking
influences.
At light. We're talking about light. So I was thinking about this, who have been the big influences on my life? And of course, you start with your parents.
Yes.
And they taught me, when you think about, it's almost like not fair to start with your parents because they've been such a colossal influence right down to the chromosomal level, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, they're a given, and they govern like so many things that you are automatically how you think or what you value because right. They were part of the beginning.
Right, right. And so, what I know of, in many cases, what I know of what home looks like, and what, glad times look like comes from
yes.
My experience of growing up in the home of Patrick and Phyllis Shea, God rest their souls. I owe them debts that I can't repay. And I, you know, and Christmas time particularly is one of those times when you inevitably start thinking back to other Christmases where, yes, you know, great things happen. And there's certain Christmases that really stick out for me.
Yes.
Through for various reasons. I have a tape recording. In 1962, my parents went out and got a brand new piece of technology that almost nobody had, a tape recorder.
Oh, my goodness.
It was amazing. It could actually record your voice. And you could not only record your voice, but you could then go back and erase it and do it again. Or you could speed up the tape player or slow it down and turn your voice into chipmunk voices. It was awesome. It was amazing. There was nothing like it on this earth. And so my parents got it, and then they dinked around with it. They bought it in November, and they dinked around with it for a month and a half before they gave it to my brothers for Christmas.
But not you.
Well, I was four. Okay. So not especially qualified to operate a tape recorder. But, however, because I was around the house, because I was only four, I wasn't in school yet. And so we have recordings of my parents dinking around with a tape recorder with me there in the background talking about stuff. You know, being an energetic little four-year-old kid.
Preparing for connecting the dots even then.
Even then. That's right. And so we have recordings of that Christmas morning in 1962.
Wow.
Of cool. Us sitting around, you know, talking and me being a 4-year-old kid. And so that, I remember that Christmas, and we have, you know, you got home movies of other Christmases. And so I remember those Christmases as well. And that you do, you think back on those times, and those are, Christmas always has just nothing but happy associations for me. You know, I hear other people talking about holiday tension and the angst of, you know, Christmas and all of this, and none of that registers for me.
It doesn't register for me either, I gotta say. I mean, when you talk about going back to Christmases, one of my earliest Christmases that I remember was going to my grandparents' home, which was this beautiful big house in Houston, and they had the world's biggest Christmas tree. I mean, it was like out of the Nutcracker kind of big. It turned out that one of their sons, my uncle, had taken two other trees, and because the tree didn't have enough in it, and so he bored holes into the tree and grafted other branches in to make it fuller and bigger and more magnificent.
Okay.
And the story is that every person that came into the house, I would take them and lead them over to see the tree. Because I was okay. Like, you got to see this.
It's magnificent.
And then I made it even more fun because I moved all the tags off the gifts and switched them. So nobody got the right gift.
Okay. Well, that's, you know, oh, you scamp.
Yes. Yeah. It's four. But,
yeah, you know, that's what you do. But yeah, so that is, you know, I could, you know, we could spend a whole show just talking about the enormous impact that, you know, your parents and your family of origin had on you. And you know, you can even start to get into things like birth order and how important your birth order is. It was,
yes,
the birth order in my family had a huge impact on me, both for good and for ill, you know, because I was the after the, to my parents' credit, it didn't occur to me until I was 25 years old that I was not an intended pregnancy.
Okay.
It just didn't dawn on me. You know, I suddenly one day when I was 25 years old, I realized there's a 9-year gap between me and my brother.
Yeah, there might be a reason for that. Okay.
You know, and so I was an oops. But, you know, they were happy to see me. And so it was like, oh, well, and so I never got any of this, you know, we never meant to have you, you know, moments from my parents when I was being an obnoxious kid. And boy, was I an obnoxious kid.
No, that's a whole other story.
You know, other tape recordings from later on in childhood. There's a recording of me when I was 11 years old that is better than a hair shirt. just listening to that kid, that awful kid. Just an awful child. I just listen to it and I think, oh, if that kid were my kid, I mean, he would just be, you know, just, yeah. I mean, you could just hear the face begging to be slapped. Yeah, just an awful child. And so I think about what my parents endured with that brat in their house, you know. But they raised me and loved me, and I'm grateful to them for that, you know. So that's a hugely important influence, of course, is my parents and my brothers. Right. My brothers were, you know, my brothers were, because they were 9 and 12 years older than me, were just these remote godlike figures.
They could do everything.
Oh, no kidding. They could do everything. They were amazing. My brother, my middle brother, Mike, could make me invisible.
Okay.
wave of his wand, because he was a magician. And so he did all these magic tricks, which were always awesome to me. And so I've grown up with I have a lifelong love of magicians. I love magic tricks. Because Mike did magic tricks when I was growing up, and he was just filled me with wonder. And that's one of the things that I remember from my childhood, is the experience of wonder. It's an enormous gift of childhood.
It is. And, for me, I was the first child and of four, and not to my credit, I identified with Lucy Van Pelt, meaning that my poor brother had to suffer as Linus does from me getting up every morning. I feel crabby today, you know, so there was that. But I grew up in Beaumont, Texas, and one of the biggest influences of childhood was that everybody did kind of, there weren't all the activities that you can do now for kids. You know, you could do art camp, you could do juggling camp, you could do whatever kind of activity you could think of. Uh-huh. There were sports. And uh-huh. I was not someone who was gifted in any way whatsoever with sports. But I could do dance. And so I had I went to dance class, and that was a huge influence on me, because I desperately wanted to be like all the beautiful ballerinas who could do all the moves, and it's not in me, but I, I followed on, you know, they took pity on me occasionally, because I just had so much Rudy like enthusiasm, you know. that's what I would say. I was desperate.
Amateur.
The passionate amateur. There you go. You know, and I took dance all, you know, for all my childhood into high school. In fact, I quit piano so that I could do dance more seriously, even though really I should have stuck with piano. But so that was a big influence. And my parents were magnificent. My mom's still alive. My mom and dad, I mean, any books that I've read have been because my mother and father have said, here, read this. Okay. This is good. You'll like this. But the big influences for me were my high school principal, who put me on the journalism class. We'll talk later. I hear the music.
We'll talk about some of our other influences when we return. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Sherry Antonetti, and we're talking about influences.
Yes.
On Redbox Media, and we'll be back right after this.
You are listening to Redbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Redbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Hello, and welcome back. Connecting the Dots. Host Mark Shea. And we're here today with Sherry Antonetti. We're talking about people who have been important influences. Now, you know, there are certain people who actually have been hugely important influences, but who you don't really know anything about.
Yeah. Right.
For example, I couldn't tell you his or her name now if my life depended on it, because I don't remember anything about him. But the most important class I ever took in high school was typing. It is how I have avoided living under a bridge. My whole adult life was knowing how to type.
Yeah, well, you jiggered a memory for me of someone I will have to thank in heaven one day, because when I was a baby, I was premature and I weighed 2 pounds, 11 ounces back in 66. And the intubation tubes caused me to have a tracheotomy. And my mother would come and visit me in the NICU almost every day. But, you know, this was very hard, 6 months where she was coming and seeing me and not getting to take me home.
Yeah.
And one day she cried to the administrator, this nun who ran the hospital, about the fact that she was worried she'd never get to take me home. Mm-hmm. And the nun went upstairs and she looked at the papers and she signed them and she talked to the doctors and she wrapped me up and unplugged me from all the machines and took me back down through the elevator, placed me in my mother's arms and said, take her home. She's yours. And that nun's name was Sister Anne Marie. So my youngest daughter is named Anna Maria in her honor.
Really?
Really.
That's mm-hmm. pretty cool. So you were taken care of by Marlo Thomas. That's impressive. I did not know that. Okay. Now I'm really dating myself.
Well, I'm dating myself because I missed it. So.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
You're in trouble.
There was a TV show on in the late 60s, actually about that time, called That Girl. And Marlo Thomas played a character named Anne Marie. And so there you go, Danny Thomas's daughter. So, you know, very Catholic name.
Yes.
But yes. Well, okay.
There's an influence, though.
That was a really stupid joke, and about a handful of people would even get the joke now. But
including your co-host, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. I'm just leaving you in the dust. You know, but that's all right. Well, you know, as far as other influences go, well. Of course, particularly since I became a believer in 1978. So scripture, of course, started to exert a huge influence on how I thought about things. And since becoming a Catholic, scripture as understood by the Catholic Church has also, of course, had a huge impact on how I look at things. And again, when you're talking about scripture, I mean, and the way in which scripture influences you. Just now, you know, I put a note up. There's some gruesome story that comes out of Alabama today about some prisoner that they executed, and it took him forever to die. And it was just this gruesome, torturous act of state-sponsored killing.
Yes.
And so I put a note up saying, you know, we should abolish the death penalty. Yes. And if you're even thinking about saying something like, well, he had it coming because of blah, 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 you know, just delete that and then just go ahead and write, I believe in being just as unspeakably cruel as a murderer.
Right.
Because that's what you're really saying, right? I think if I were left to my own desserts, and to my own devices, I would be one of those people that would be saying, you know, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. It's right there in the Bible, you know. But one of the things that I began to realize, of course, was the way in which we read the Bible is shown to us by the church. And one of the things that the church has very wisely said is killing isn't something that you get to do.
Right.
Killing is something that tragically sometimes you have to do in a last ditch resort. But if you can avoid killing people, then obviously you want to avoid killing people.
Yeah, the way to think of it is there's no point at which you get to sin.
Right. You don't get to kill people. Sometimes you have to kill somebody, you know, in a desperate situation. But, you know, the moment you're in a position where you don't have to kill them, the church says, then don't kill them, which means get rid of the death penalty. Because yes. Nobody on death row is somebody that you have to kill. There are other things that you can do.
They
to
can't hurt anyone. They're stuck. Yeah.
And once the church points that out, you know, you start to realize that's really true. And if you then look at what the church says and say, well, how can I figure out a way around that so that I do get to kill people?
You're thinking wrong.
You're doing Catholic wrong, and you're doing pro-life wrong. And all of that comes to me, of course, not because of my native goodness, but because the church, which is a huge influence on the way that I think, says, think differently. And so Scripture and the church have been a huge influence on me as well.
Right. And the other way in which you get influenced is like by the witness of other people. Like when I was in college, I'd wanted to do something different for Lent. You know, I'd given up chocolate. I'd given up Diet Coke. Wanted to do something important, and I didn't know what. And the people at the lunch table next to me were falling over themselves laughing. I thought they were drunk. That's how much fun they were having laughing with each other.
Okay.
And I asked them what they were doing, and they were talking about what they had done that morning. They had been volunteers at this place called Logan Center. And they worked with the handicapped running a recreational program. I thought, well, I'll do that. Well, that turned into my profession as a result. I went to graduate school in special education because of I had the witness of these people, and I started doing it for Lent, and I had so much fun. I kept going after Lent was over. Mm-hmm. And so then when I figured, what am I going to do after I graduate from college? I went to graduate school in special ed, and it turned out to be helpful for now when I have a son with Down syndrome. A lot of what I learned has come back full circle to be able to help me to work with him. And so these friends that I didn't know then were an influence because of their joy.
Well, isn't that cool? And that's true too, of course. Other influences, when I became a Christian, of course, the other Christians that I knew that happened to live on my dorm floor were a colossal influence. It was, this group of non-denominational evangelicals, Protestants, many of them former Catholics, who they're the ones that taught me how to read my Bible, how to, pray in community, how to live in community, how to take responsibility, for my actions and, all these other things. And so they were really, in many ways, I refer to them as my personal Old Testament. They were the people who kind of prepared me for becoming a Catholic.
That is really cool.
So people ask me, why did you become a Catholic? And my response has always been, well, because I wanted to be the best evangelical I could be. and that meant becoming a Catholic, because everything that I learned as an evangelical was preparation for what the church teaches, So I'm grateful to those guys too, I'm also, I was thinking about this today. I was taking a walk, and I was thinking, who've been big influences on me? I'm constantly running into people who are just baffled by how I navigate moral decision making. I seem to be just an impenetrable mystery to so many people who just can't imagine how I can be a Catholic and say X or do Y. And it's like, to me, this is not complicated at all. So practically everything you need to know about, how I navigate the moral world comes from G.K. Chesterton. Huge influence.
Wonderful.
Perhaps an even more foundational influence for me is J.R.R. Tolkien.
Okay.
Because Tolkien has a deeply Catholic view of moral decision making and
everything.
Foundational to Tolkien, and therefore foundational to my moral outlook all the time I've grown up, is you must not do evil that good may come of it. That's the lesson of the ring.
Yes,
of course.
There's no way to use the ring for good. It just can't be done.
You can't do it. And I internalize that very, very deeply. That, you know, whenever someone says, just use the ring and it'll all be great.
Danger, Will Robinson, danger, danger, danger.
That's where my red flags go off, you know? And so that's always been a foundational principle for me. And of course, another very foundational principle is the law is made for man, not man for the law. And so mere rules, simply because they're rules that wind up hurting human beings, I just go, well, okay, in that case, the rule's less important than the human being. We'll be back right after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Sherry Antonetti talking about big influences in our lives. And we'll be back right after this.
Sounds good.
If you enjoy listening to Mark Shea and all of his wonderful co-hosts here on Connecting the Dots, then consider becoming a friend of the show and provide your support today. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show. Thank you.
Welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Sherry Antonetti. By the way, if you want to join the conversation, give us a call. We're at 1-573-4-BREAD-4. You can also text us at that number. You can tweet us at Breadbox Media. So just getting back to Tolkien's influence on me. The great core moral lesson of Tolkien is you shall not do evil that good may come of it.
Yes.
And this is, of course, is a foundational principle of Catholic moral teaching, and it is also, by no small coincidence, the most popular moral heresy on planet Earth.
For the greater good.
It's controversial. I mean, the idea that you can do evil for the greater good. It's funny because one of the she's not for me a particularly big influence, mostly because my moral views on life were already set in concrete by the time she came along. But it's interesting that J.K. Rowling.
Yes.
One of the things that she, you know, her. Her villains emphasize doing evil for the greater good. And in fact, she uses that phrase for the greater good on a couple of occasions to illustrate, you know, sort of the central mistake that the villains in her world make. And yet the irony is that Rowling herself, some of her good characters make what are essentially consequentialist judgments.
Same error.
So they do the same thing, you know, but I suspect that's just a flaw in her overall very positive. I'm a big fan of Rowling.
I am too.
I think that her series is very good, but I think that there's just a certain amount of squish in her moral worldview.
There is.
That lets people get away with that. But on the whole, you know, I like and Rowling as a human being, I think the world of. I think she is just a magnificent human being. She has.
I want to be her when I grow up. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that she's just a tremendous person. And over again, you know, I will hear about her, you know, giving some fabulous sum to some charity or something. She deliberately, she was the richest person in Britain at one point, yes. And she deliberately, well, I wouldn't say impoverished herself, but she
gave
certainly
away so she wouldn't
has
be.
Been. Yeah, she, you know, she recognizes that it's not all about money. And
I also,
so,
you know, I'm fraternally grateful to her for the fact that she helped 6 of my 10 children fall in love with reading.
Oh, well, good for her.
You know, yeah. I mean, the oldest 6 all, you know, grew up on that.
I think the first time that she sort of came to my attention, not as an author, but just as a human, was I remember reading a story about her. There was some girl in the United States, a young girl who was dying of some species of cancer. And somehow or other, Rowling got wind of it. And so Rowling started calling her. She lived in, I think, Maryland or something. And she was working on the Goblet of Fire at the time. And so she knew that this girl was dying and was not going to live to see the book come out. And so every week after she had drafted a chapter or, you know, written the next part of the book, she would call this girl and she would read what she had written to her.
Oh, my gosh.
Over the phone. Yeah. You just go.
That is so amazingly cool.
I love you. You know?
Yes, exactly.
You are a magnificent human being.
Well, it's like the girl who is Luna Lovegood in the movies was anorexic. And J.K. Rowling cast her and kind of wrote that part to kind of bring her out.
Really?
To take care of her.
Isn't that fantastic? Yeah. You know, people like that, you know, you just love somebody like, and speaking of the movies, I was thinking about this while I was taking a walk. Another thing that another person who's had a huge influence on me and really, I think stronger than anybody else. I had a conversation recently with Robert George on this show here. And okay. Robert George has wrote a thing on immigrants. His own family were immigrants, so his family immigrated from Syria. Okay. And he talks about what made immigrants such great Americans, why they integrated so, and this happened again and again and again, into the American experience. And it was, he said, the secret sauce, if you will, was gratitude. They were really grateful to be living in this country where they didn't have to fear a knock on the door at midnight,
yes.
You know, because they were Jews or whatever. And and
it's
so
nice.
He says, yeah, it's nice. Not having, and he said, what was amazing was that even, you know, when they wound up in West Virginia, you know, at one point his grandparents had the KKK come to their house and like burn a cross on their lawn. And the lesson that they took away from this was not America is a fraud after all. The lesson they took away from it was these guys are jackasses and they're not real Americans, right?
Yes.
Because that's not what Americans do, you know?
Right.
And so they were as patriotic as they could possibly be all the time, you know, all the rest of their lives when they came to the United States. And one of the people that you see who manifest that, who was himself, I'm not sure if he was an immigrant himself or just the son of immigrants. I think he might have been an immigrant himself, but as a child, is Frank Capra.
Yes.
And Frank Capra, you know, people are mystified a lot of times, I think, by my view on American patriotism. I'm a patriot. I believe in the Second Commandment, and the Second Commandment is love your neighbor, and all patriotism is just the Second Commandment applied to your countrymen.
Yes.
But, you know, when I look at somebody like Frank Capra, and you watch a film like, take your pick, you know, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. Meet John Doe. These are films that are made by a patriot. This is somebody who loves America. Just right from his guts, he loves America, and he understands America as an immigrant understands America.
That's true.
And when I look at, for example, the kind of xenophobia and racism that has that somebody like Trump has appealed to. I don't oppose that because I've read, you know, people keep telling me you're a communist or something. I'm not a communist. I hate communism. You know, communism is the biggest murder machine ever invented in the history of the world. The real reason I despise that kind of xenophobia and that
it's not American.
Bigotry is it's not American. I learned it not from Marx. I learned it from Frank Capra, who's the biggest flag-waving American who ever made a movie, you know, maybe less than John Wayne, you know. But, he made a whole slew of movies during World War II that were, you know, themselves just uber patriotic, you know. And some people think those things are corny. I just look at them and think, yeah, this is what it means to be an American. You know,
he believed in America's goodness.
Yeah.
You know, even though there were flaws and there were real people with real problems that were in those films, yeah, he believed in America's fundamental goodness and that we should aspire to that goodness.
Right, right. You see the same thing in It's a Wonderful Life, you know.
Yes.
What does George Bailey do all day? Well, you know, from George Bailey's perspective, he gives human beings a home. There's something his father says deep in the race about a need for a home, you know. How does Mr. Potter talk about what George Bailey does? Play a nursemaid to a bunch of garlic eaters, right?
Yes, exactly.
And, that's
the difference.
Because Italians were the Latinos of their time.
Yes.
You know, they were the ones who were the alien influence coming in. You know, the high water mark of the KKK was not after the Civil War. It was 1924 when the KKK had the largest rolls. And the reason they had so many people signing up is because you had a bunch of papist garlic eaters.
I'm married to a papist garlic eater.
Yeah. Why, yes, you are, Antonetti.
Yes.
But absolutely, you know, and so, I look at, you know, another huge, as I realize it, is that another great influence on me and the way I look at the world, especially the way I look at my country and my people, comes to me from a great Catholic Italian immigrant named Frank Capra.
That's cool. Everybody go watch It's a Wonderful Life tonight and you'll feel all better.
It's a great movie. Everything. You might say it's a wonderful movie.
You would. But that is also how we will save this world. That's how we'll influence the world under the current incoming administration is by fighting the battles of Bedford Falls all over the place.
Yes, no kidding. Yeah. And it's, you know, it is. It's something to be grateful for. One of the things that Pope Benedict says, you know, is that the way in which you show your gratitude to all the things that you've been given that you can never possibly repay to the people who gave them to you because they're dead or, you know,
moved on or whatever it is. Yes.
So what do you do? Well, you pay it forward. You be that influence for the next generation, for the people that are coming next, so that they can look back and say, you know, not every heel was in Germany and Japan after all. And so, you fight the battle of Bedford Falls here, too.
On that note, yes. So,
yeah. All right. Well, I want to thank you.
Have a great week.
Thank you. I want to thank you so much for being on the show today, Sherry Antonetti. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots. Our producer today was Danny Head. And I will be back tomorrow with Mr. Michael Litchens. Until then, have a great evening.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.